Welcome to the South Carolina Lead, a podcast that breaks down state political news for you and provides insight on legislative happenings under the Statehouse Dome in Columbia. Hello, I'm your host, Gavin Jackson, and this episode is for the week of May 29th, 2018. One set of gubernatorial primary debates is done, and we're here recapping the action with the reporters who covered it all. We talk about who threw punches, who stood out, who stayed on message, and much more. The Lead is a podcast where we go beyond the headlines with the reporters who wrote the stories affecting you. Every Tuesday, we give you a roundup of news, insight into the week's biggest story, campaign trail intrigue, and a chaser of trivia. You can listen to it all while you recover from that sweet indoor Memorial Day party you had this weekend. Wait, did you? I hope you didn't grill inside. Hashtag carbon monoxide. Or you've abandoned us for that hot new Spoleto Backstage podcast.
Cross promotion.
Ooh, caliente. Now for our brief quorum call. Quorum call is a term to see if there's majority present, but here on the South Carolina Lead, we know majority of the time that you're not always current with the news. So here's a quick recap of several top stories you should know about. And just so you know, since our discussion runs long, I've condensed the campaign trail into the quorum call for this episode. Number one, the Post and Courier's Jamie Lovegrove broke a huge story about 5th Congressional Democratic candidate Archie Parnell's history of domestic violence. Divorce records from 1973 obtained by the Post and Courier show that Parnell physically abused his ex-wife, Kathleen, multiple times. Records show that even one night, she fled to a friend's apartment for her own safety, and Archie used a tire iron to break down the door. Parnell has remained defiant in staying in the race, despite protests by his campaign staff, which has summarily quit. All three Democratic gubernatorial candidates, Congressman Jim Clyburn, and others have called for Parnell to quit. As of Friday, May 24th, he is still in the race. Parnell had narrowly lost to Representative Ralph Norman in last year's special election to replace Representative Mick Mulvaney. Number two, Republican gubernatorial candidate Catherine Templeton named 13th Judicial Circuit Solicitor Walt Witkins as her running mate. Wilkins is the prosecutor for Pickens and Greenville counties and comes from a family well known in South Carolina politics. The Greenville News notes that his father is Billy Wilkins, who served as solicitor and is a former chief judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. His uncle is David Wilkins, a former U.S. ambassador to Canada and who served 11 years as Speaker of the South Carolina House of Representatives. Number three, the Post and Courier reports that census estimates show South Carolina's largest cities did not add the most new residents last year, and the second largest city, Columbia, even lost population. Now, smaller towns and cities like Fort Mill, Bluffton, Hanahan, Greer, and Somerville all gained more population than Charleston, Columbia, North Charleston, or Greenville. And number four, Governor Henry McMaster vetoed a bill that expands the nonviolent crimes ex-cons can get removed from their records, saying, quote, criminal history, like all history, should not be erased, quote, according to the Post and Courier. Supporters say that bipartisan bill has the twofold benefit of improving people's lives while helping employers fill job openings, since criminal records can prevent people from getting an interview. Now, backers of this bill include the Chamber of Commerce, and the veto is expected to be overridden. And just like a candidate dodging a debate question, we've buried the lead once again. We just had our first set of gubernatorial primary debates hosted by South Carolina ETV and the Post and Courier last week. Even though we're taping this podcast on Friday, let's pretend it's Tuesday for everyone's sake. I was part of a panel of journalists on stage at Clemson University who questioned all five Republican candidates and the three Democratic candidates. So to unpack those two big debates, I invited journalists who covered them, including the Associated Press's Meg Kennard and the Post and Courier's Jamie Lovegrove. Meg and Jamie, welcome back.
Thanks, Gavin. Hey, Evan.
Meg, let's kick this off with the Republican debate. They debated first on Wednesday, and we did see Lieutenant Governor Kevin Bryant, Yancey McGill, Governor Henry McMaster, Catherine Templeton, and John Warren. Those are all five of the Republican candidates that were on stage up there. What was the expectation of this debate, and why was it so important, that debate with the Republican candidates?
Essentially, this was the first time that we got to see Governor Henry McMaster facing off with those four challengers you just named off. They've been talking, they've been meeting, but he hasn't been part of the discussion. So this was really the first time for voters to see him in that campaign context with the people who want his job. And, you know, there has been over the past year plus, there have been a lot of stories swirling around that tangentially involve the governor related to the State House corruption investigation. He's not part of it, but his former political consultant and other people tied to him are. So this also would have been a first opportunity for the people challenging him, who had plenty to say about that investigation.
We've seen campaign ads. We saw Templeton launch a campaign
in
ad against
ads,
that.
Ads, on the trail, different events. They've had plenty to say about it. But it didn't come up during the debate. And so I think that that may have been kind of a swing and a miss a little bit in terms of something of substance they could have talked about.
Charles Bierbauer was the moderator of that debate. I was up there questioning. So was Andy Shane, Columbia Bureau Chief for the Post and Courier. And he was making the same discussion, the same point that, you know, that was the whole expectation. That's what we were all kind of anticipating was going to be that kind of pounce on Henry moment, because that's what they've been doing at these other forums when he's not present.
Right.
So I was, you know, either it was going to be all jump on Henry, or it was going to be let's sell ourselves to this statewide audience that is also watching. And I think the latter was obviously what happened. What do you think, Jamie?
Yeah, I think, you know, I saw folks the day afterwards saying, oh, you know, the format wasn't what I expected last night. It seemed like more of a forum than a debate. You know, I don't know if the candidates didn't understand what their options were in terms of rebuttal, or if they just chose to take a very different strategy. But it was not the format of the debate that was the issue. It was that they simply chose to lay back and not really push back on the governor's statements until really deep into the debate, when Lieutenant Governor Kevin Bryant started pushing back on Planned Parenthood.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw from the Democrats, you know, the next night that you really can get into some pretty feisty back and forth if you take advantage of it. So I was surprised by the fact that after spending the last several weeks complaining that they didn't have a chance to take on the governor one-on-one, that they finally got that opportunity and didn't really take it. I will be interested to see whether, you know, they kind of viewed this as a warm-up round for the next debates in Columbia in June, and whether they'll take a more aggressive approach that time. But it was surprising that they did not try to land some more direct body hits on the governor, who still remains the front runner at this point.
And Jimmy, we saw some people up there who have been around politics in the state government for years. Obviously, McMaster's been up there for around 30 years. Mm-hmm. Kevin Bryant's been in there. Yancey McGill, former Democratic senator, turned was also lieutenant governor, and then is now a Republican. They were pretty polished. We saw some pretty good stances. I think Yancey went on a good bit more. Sometimes he did go over his time a couple times, but it also stops mid-word when we
very
say,
politely.
Hey, you got to stop, Yancey. But we saw some of that. What are some of the takeaways? What did the viewers at home see when they saw these candidates? I mean, were they differentiating themselves from each other well, or was there a lot of commonality among these guys?
I think this is a fairly different group of folks. I think Republican primary voters do have some clear options to choose from here. I think the big question is going to be specifically whether primary voters differentiate between Catherine Templeton and John Warren. Right now, it seems like for most of the polling we've seen in the race, that the dynamic is that the governor is, you know, certainly in first place, but does not seem to be close to getting that 50% threshold that he needs to avoid a runoff. So there's really a battle between Catherine Templeton and John Warren for that second place spot, so they can take the governor on one-on-one. And they are the two, you know, they have really, from the day John
outsiders.
Warren got in the race, they've been using the exact same phrases. We're conservative outsiders. I can't be bought. You know, all this kind of stuff. You know, Warren has that military background that he can certainly talk about and does all of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And Catherine has that experience in state government, in the executive branch, that she talks about as sort of balancing out her outsider, you know, status, whether or not, you know, that's the case. So, you know, and of course she's a woman as well,
yeah.
And she's the only woman in the race. So in this primary. So there, that's really the question for me, is whether or not they can differentiate between those two candidates.
Well, and we were just talking, Templeton did say on stage that she was the only candidate on that stage that night that has experience in the executive branch. And,
yeah, it's not obviously
the governor is obviously the executive
the
branch.
Lieutenant governor.
And then you have a former lieutenant governor. I mean, so it's basically just
everyone
just
John Warren. Experience in the executive branch.
What about you, Meg? Did they differentiate themselves? I asked that last question, you know, insider versus outsider, if that's a good thing or a bad thing. What did the viewers at home see if they were watching basically for the first time? Because we are, you know, we're getting close to the primary. People are probably just now tuning into this. Do they see differences among these guys?
I think Jamie's right that there is diversity in this field. But, you know, voters are really, on both the Democrat and Republican sides of the ticket, are really being asked to think about whether experience in government is something that they value in this election. You know, people ask me all the time, having covered the 2016 race, like, what did we learn from that? And there is a myriad of lessons, but one of them is people don't necessarily want somebody with a ton of experience. At least they didn't for president and not in politics. So, you know, I'm not saying that that's analogous to the governor's race here this year, but it is still on the minds of voters. This is the first time that voters are being asked to really consider anybody for anything since the 2016 races. And so when they look at a field that has a sitting governor, whom they didn't elect governor, but is still the governor, they have a lieutenant governor, whom they didn't elect lieutenant governor, but is still the lieutenant governor, and then a couple of other candidates, and then some who've never been in elected office. They really are having to think about that and asking, you know, the issues that came up. Abortion is always an issue that's going to come up on the Republican side of things. There was a lot of agreement there, as we would imagine. But, you know, in really parsing down into some of the other issues like the VC summer debacle, what do we do with education, things like that, you know, there were some differences, at least in terms of what we'll do to fix it, that came up. And so in addition to the experience, you know, voters now really do have some facts to chew on.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, the abortion being a key example of there are, in both the Republican and Democratic primaries, a lot of policy similarities between these folks. When we say they are different, you know, oftentimes it is their approach towards the same end goal and their character type, as we say, the experience they bring to the job. Those are, and that's the case in a lot of primaries. You know, at the end of the day, you're opposing folks who are in the same political party as you are. You're generally going to agree on a lot of the policy issues. You may just disagree on how aggressive you should be about going about achieving that, whether or not you should work with the legislature or work against the legislature. Those are the kind of differences that we're really seeing between these candidates.
Yeah, and we were seeing, you know, I know Andy Sheehan was asking some interesting questions too that night, just basically about how much power you have as governor. We'll get into this especially more with the Democratic debate, because there was a lot of lofty rhetoric there as well. But it's just you don't have much power as governor in South Carolina. I mean, Meg, can you break it down about just what our situation is in South Carolina and basically, like, what are they going to be able to do if they become governor? I mean, what is it? I mean, you're going to have to work with the legislature, essentially, to get everything done anyway.
That's right. I mean, at the end of it all, a lot of these gubernatorial candidates are saying that they will do this and they will do that and they will fix it, but they can't. It's not something that's in their purview. South Carolina has one of the strongest legislatures in terms of what they're empowered to do, and one of the weakest governors in terms of what they're not empowered to do. There are executive orders that can be signed, just as there are at the presidential level. But, you know, here, our governor really doesn't have a whole lot of leeway. There's veto options, for sure, whenever the budget comes up, and the governor can go through that and throw out certain parts. But a lot of times, that just gets overridden anyway. So, you know, from the governor's standpoint, a lot of it really does come down to ideology and personal perspective and the ability to say, you know, to voters, this is what I stand for. This is why you should support me, because you align with me on these issue areas. But when it really comes down to actually putting forth a plan to get that done, the governor has to have the buy-in of the legislature to really make substantive changes, to put agencies together, as some of the candidates have proposed doing, or streamline them in certain regulatory ways. You know, a lot of that has to be done at the legislative level. And so the governor really can't get a lot of it done his or herself. And so they've got to have that support from lawmakers. A lot of it in these debates, it's great to hear people on the record. It's great to hear what their thoughts are. But in terms of actually being able to just say unilaterally, okay, now we do it this way, that's just not possible.
Yeah. And particularly in the Republican primary, perhaps the most egregious example of this is the folks, several of whom said, I'm going to cut taxes on day one. Good luck. I mean, that's just not something you can do. You can propose cutting taxes, as Governor McMaster has done. He has proposed it. But it is extremely a legislative task there. You can approve tax cuts, but you have absolutely no authority to cut
them yourself. And that's a good point, because I did ask them, you know, we have all these needs in the state. We have $2 billion in maintenance and renovation needs alone, just basic needs in the state. And I said, do we have enough money? And all of them said, yes, we do have enough money. And obviously got a different response from the Democrats, but it was just interesting to hear that and some other surprises we heard from
them
there.
And that aligns with, you know, I mean, the conservative philosophy is that it's not a matter of more spending, it's a matter of more efficient spending.
Yeah, auditing agencies looking for that money.
You know, I think what several governors have discovered over the years after campaigning on more efficient spending and after campaigning on auditing these agencies is we do audit a lot of these agencies. We do look very closely for any penny that we can spend. This is not the idea that these lawmakers and these governors in the past have just been, you know, recklessly blowing money all over the place. I think folks, once they get into the office, they realize it's a little harder to find some of this waste that they talk about in vague terms once you get into the nitty-gritty. You can cut programs. I mean, you can talk about doing that. And we did ask them,
what state agency
would you eliminate? You know, you can cut things. But in terms of making a significant amount of money just on quote-unquote efficiency, that is a difficult thing to do.
Well, I think also to Jamie's point, there is some streamlining that can be done in a variety of ways. But one, an interesting question to press on all of these candidates is, okay, so you've done that and you still decide that you need to find a chunk of money to, you know, get from point A to point B. What do you propose as a new revenue stream?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's something, you know, a lot of Democrats, especially at the beginning of the legislative session, that's something that the minority caucus came through and said, okay, well, what about marijuana? Or what, you know, they actually
or
came
casinos,
up with
yeah.
right, some ideas. And that came up in the gubernatorial debate, too. But you know, I found that is always an interesting question to put to these candidates because they do talk about, yes, especially you know, the conservative side of things, well, we're going to cut the fat. And
yeah.
I'm not going to use the B word that's come up in terms of being able to cut agency fat. We've all heard it enough.
Is it some sort of tool?
I'm just not going to talk about it.
John Warren says you can buy it.
You
at
just
Home
go to
oh,
Home Depot.
Oh, yeah. What
my nightmares, stop.
I'm sure we're going to put a sound effect in somehow.
Right. But, you know, there is some of that that you can do. But, you know, aside from that, then what else? Where are we going to find new ways
besides
to make this
the assumption of trickle-down economics by cutting taxes?
Yeah, just banking on something that may or may not happen.
Getting rid of that much revenue and hoping it will
And she did
back.
Do that. I mean, obviously, that is where the word that shall not be used came from.
I think when we say that, we're just going to make a sound effect right there. Like when we say campaign trail or
It was a headline in the Post and Courier years ago when she was at DHEC that she's always referring to now. You can thank Bo Peterson for all those ads that you've been seeing. You know, she did come in and she fired a bunch of people and she was cutting all kinds of stuff. And that was where that reputation came from. And she can come in and she can do that again. You know, I think one thing that folks should think about politically is there are a lot of state employees who vote.
Yeah.
They are not, you know, certainly the largest constituency of all, but there are many thousands of them.
Yeah.
And a lot of them vote in Republican primaries. And, you know, we've heard from some who say, you know, when she's shooting that snake in the ad, I am the snake. I don't want to get fired. And, you know, I don't think that that's going to be a decisive factor in here, but they do vote and they matter.
Retirees and current employees, for sure. Let's switch gears to the Democrats. I know we've really talking through a lot of this, but that's important because this is coming down the home stretch here. Businessman Phil Noble, Representative James Smith, a Democrat from Columbia, and lawyer Marguerite Willis debated Thursday night, and it was quite a different atmosphere from Wednesday. I don't know if you want to pick up on this or not, Jamie, but Shauna Adcox with the Post and Courier and I were asking questions with Charles Beerbauer, of course. And for me, the set didn't feel like, at least in the beginning, it didn't feel as tense as it did at the Republican debate. I don't know if because we were all just, you know, thinking that things were going to jump. I kind of had some anticipation of what was going to happen last night at the Democrats debate, but it just seemed like there was a little bit more tense atmosphere of the Republican debate. But what was that changed pretty quickly, though, because the Democrats did start kind of kicking it up pretty quick. What did we see from the Democratic debate?
Well, I think part of the thing here is because of the fact that, as we said, it was the first time the Republicans got their chance to debate with Governor McMaster on stage. It was kind of a new challenge for them. It was a new environment to be in. The Democrats have been all over the state together for a long time now. They went to all those county conventions together. They have debated twice now, I believe, before this one. They know each other kind of inside out. They know what their what each other's strengths are, what each other's weaknesses are. And it has become, frankly, very personal and pretty bitter at times throughout this race. There has been some very heated rhetoric. Up until now, James Smith has kind of tried to rise above it all and kind of really focus on himself. But he couldn't really help himself but fight back a couple times last night. That was a very feisty response at one point to Marguerite Willis, in which he said, you know, while I've been fighting in the legislature, you've been trying to make money for yourself as a corporate lawyer. She pushed back and said, you know, I've been serving in other ways. I've been, you know, helping in philanthropy. I've been serving on college boards, trustees. But, you know, yeah, this again, because of the fact that there are not a whole lot of really significant policy differences between them, you know, this is the way it happens in primaries. It often becomes kind of a personal battle. And that's really what it has become in the Democratic race.
Meg, what was your initial takeaways?
To me, again, going back to the whole experience thing, you know, mm-hmm. like Jamie said, these folks have been together. We've kind of seen how they lie on various issues. But last night really seemed to be a real, I don't want to say battle, because that makes it sound like it was more combative than it was, but mm-hmm. it really was a very active conversation displaying the differences between an experienced politician. I don't say that in a bad way. It just is what it is. He's been in the legislature for more than two decades.
Yeah. Yeah.
James Smith. But somebody with political experience. And then two other people who, like on the Republican side of things, are painting themselves as outsiders, just mm-hmm. on the different side of the political spectrum. Both Marguerite Willis and Phil Noble took opportunities to go after James Smith for a variety of things that they saw as bad things that have happened during his time in the legislature, seemingly trying to tie him to, you know, these awful things that have come out of Columbia, these problems that we all have to suffer through, and they happened during your tenure. Smith, to his credit, pointed out, okay, well, one of the really big bad things you're talking about, the Baseload Review Act, I was actually fighting in Afghanistan when that vote happened. I wasn't here. And also, on top of that, pretty much everything you're talking about through the legislature, our party's not in control.
Yeah.
The Republicans control both chambers, have for some time. So it's not that I haven't been trying. And he actually did do a good job, I think, listing off some things that he's worked on that have had mm-hmm. success. But also did really remind them, okay, so you can't just say it's all negative. I've been doing the best I can, but our party's not in control.
You're talking that Marguerite Willis kind of going right after Smith on that. She said, what someone does in a job is what you look at when you hire them to do a similar job. And he flunks this test. That's Marguerite Willis going after James Smith right there. And then Smith pushed back, like we were talking about, because he said you're either being naive or dishonest to talk about mm-hmm. that. Because, again, the Democrats are not in control of the State House. He can't get things done. They're trying to, you know, work as best as they can with Republicans to get some things done. But to kind of go after Smith like that when he can't do anything about it besides just try and get things done on their own, it seemed like his response, every time they got James to rebut something, he kind of came back and they almost kind of maybe regret even setting him up for those responses because he just hit right back even harder.
It gave him another opportunity to, you know, not just remind everybody, yes, I've been in elected office for a while, but I mean, what he's actually been doing. And he did have substantive answers on issue areas like equal pay and things like mm-hmm. that he's worked with colleagues in the legislature to actually make progress on, or at least, you know, make an effort.
Yeah.
We can talk a little bit about that NFL question if we want to. We don't have to.
Not relevant.
Yeah, some people getting fired up about the First Amendment. But we did see, you know, again, about that question, you know, whether or not, you know, you believe it's an interesting, if it's a respectful way to protest kneeling for the national anthem. Because, again, this is all rooted in the whole fact about protesting police brutality, which, again, James Smith was the only one to actually touch on that in his response to it. And, again, like I said, that was an interesting question to ask these candidates. I know they don't have control over the NFL. They can't tell players not to do it. Mm-hmm. But you want to see what these guys think about First Amendment rights, especially when you had Republicans kind of going against that, you know, talking about college free speech situations the night before. So did anything else really strike you guys when some of these responses? I mean, there was that one rebuttal when Phil Noble pointed to James Smith and Marguerite Willis and said, here's the problem right here. We're talking about a corporate lawyer and a, quote, like a career politician type situation. Anything else step out to you guys?
One thing I'll first just say about the NFL thing, you know, if we were only going to talk exclusively about the actual powers that the governor has, it'd be a very short debate. Most of what we're talking about here are things that go beyond the purview of the governor, quite frankly.
Yeah.
You're trying to find out who this person is going to be as the figurehead of the state, as the person who, you know, is on the signs on the side of the road, the person who you see on TV. You know, you are going to be one of the biggest roles, frankly, the only roles for the governor in South Carolina is the bully pulpit. And, you know, Governor McMaster ran ads during the Super Bowl about standing for the national anthem. This, you know, this is something that folks, there is a role for the governor here in leading the way as a ideas person and as a representative of the state. And so, you know, the idea that we should only be talking just about, you know, the few things that the governor can actually do. They do proclamations, they do all that kind of stuff. So it, that is a part of the job.
Well, and it's another avenue into the personality of, you know, who we're asking voters to support.
Yeah.
I mean, this is an issue not only was topical, you know, in the past week in terms of national news that's come out on the topic, but like Jamie said, the governor ran ads during the Super Bowl. He issued an executive order or proclamation about encouraging South Carolinians to stand during the Super Bowl and the national anthem. So it is a way to let voters know, okay, so yes, I understand there are only certain things that the governor can do, but here's what I think about things that are relevant across the board.
And just one quick outro question with you guys. What do you think we're going to see in the next round of debates, June 4th and June 5th by ETV and the Post and Courier? Jamie, really quick.
I do expect that the Republicans may start to take a little bit more of an aggressive stance and try to go at each other a little more, step out of their comfort zones maybe a little bit and away from the stump speeches. I mean, of course, you're going to stick to what your strengths are. But I think what will also be may depend on is if there's any more polling between now and then, if folks have an idea of where they are. You know, if you're further behind than we thought, then you're going to come out hitting people aggressively. If you're doing better than you thought you were doing, maybe you might take a little bit of backseat and just try to keep things at the status quo. So that may impact what we see in the Republican debate.
What do you think, Matt? What are we going to see next round?
We've been talking about it for a while, but we've now finally entered the time frame where voters are paying attention. Yep. They're having to really pick who they're going to support. And so this next round of debates happens just a week before voters actually go to the polls. If anything, this is going to be the last chance for them to really draw those lines of contrast among themselves and with their competitors. Also, you know, I know it's June, but there could always be an October surprise. We could always have that oppo.
It is South Carolina.
That oppo information, right. I mean, that comes out at the very last minute, intentionally timed, typically, that really can change people's minds, you know, one way or the other. So I think, you know, we really are just going to have to wait and see what comes out. But we're finally at the point where voters are going to be making up their minds.
Great. Well, guys, great insight as always. I'm glad we got to recap that debate. And of course, we're looking forward to the next one already. We'll continue to discuss these primaries as we go forward. Like Meg said, we are quickly getting to the June 12th primary day. And as always, we'll be here to tell you what's going on and give you as much information as we can so you can be informed when you go to cast your ballot on June 12th. Thank you, Jamie Lovegrove with the Post and Courier and Meg Kennard with the Associated Press for joining me today.
Always a pleasure, Gavin.
Thanks.
In our final section, Did You Know?, we focus on one quirky function of the state, politics, or government. It's named after the parliamentary procedure lawmakers use when speaking to each other. Now, we don't have Russ McKinney on this week because he's stumped me too many times, but anyway, not here nor there. We're just going to go with it. But did you know that the Order of the Palmetto is South Carolina's greatest civilian honor? It was instituted by Governor John West in 1971 and is awarded by the governor to an individual in grateful recognition of your contributions and friendships to the state of South Carolina and her people. The honoree receives a certificate signed by the governor and bearing an impression of the state seal. Now, the award is thought to have been modeled on the Commonwealth of Kentucky's practice of awarding people the title of Colonel to their names. Colonel Jackson does sound pretty cool. Governor Jim Hodges later appointed a screening committee to review nominations and make recommendations for the Order of the Palmetto and other gubernatorial awards. As of October 2004, over 3,500 Order of the Palmetto awards have been made. Now, this Did You Know is brought to you by scencyclopedia.org. The South Carolina Lead is one of many ways SCETV wants to help keep you informed. Check out the latest news and live streams on sceTV.org. Listen to coverage from South Carolina Public Radio and tune in Friday evenings at 7:30 to all ETV stations for This Week in South Carolina. All of that, this podcast, and more is available on sceTV's super easy-to-use app and scpublicradio.org. Follow us on Instagram at scledepod, that's at scleadpod, where you can see photos from the studio, around the statehouse, and on assignment. We're also on Twitter with the same handle, at scleadpod. Email questions, comments, or your gripes to scled@scetv.org. The South Carolina Lead is produced in partnership with South Carolina ETV, South Carolina Public Radio, a special thanks to the Post and Courier and the Associated Press. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Sean Birch is our supervising producer. Caitlin Park is our social media consultant. Tom Posey is our executive producer. This episode was recorded and produced in South Carolina Public Radio's studios here in Columbia on May 25th, 2018. I'm Gavin Jackson. Thanks for listening.
Secret message. Batman is a sovereign citizen.